And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. This is another pre-recorded show. I seem to be in the thralls of a nice case of the flu. So while I'm able to broadcast, I'm doing these shows. This is the second part of our show about the Battle of Los Angeles, which is a little-known incident that occurred during World War II, February of 42. The locals were under the impression the Japanese were attacking. John Belushi made a comedy about it. But in actuality, it was something much more serious than Japanese aircraft flying over the city. It was a giant craft that was caught on radar. It just appeared 120 miles off the coast. And as it came into Los Angeles, it was the anti-aircraft guns from the 4th Anti-Aircraft Command that opened fire. Of course, they were having very little impact. The unit involved under the aegis of the command was the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade, under which was the 65th Coast Artillery Regiment, located in Inglewood, and the 205th Coastal Artillery Regiment, located in Santa Monica. Now, they were the two initial units that engaged this craft. Both regiments had 3-inch and 37-millimeter anti-aircraft guns, and between those guns and the surrounding batteries, they fired 10 tons of ammunition at this mysterious craft, which of course rained down all over L.A. and the surrounding cities. At higher elevations, the 3-inch guns and the 1.5-inch shells of the 37-millimeter guns made no visible impact. As the object turned south along the surf line near El Segundo and headed toward Redondo Beach, it lowered its altitude to parallel the beach just above the ocean. Just after passing the Edison plant, it turned diagonally inland toward the southeast, crossing almost directly over the Happy Hour Cafe, barely staying above the low-lying hills it crested along Garnet Street, dropped to the south side of the hill along Torrance Boulevard and crossed over the 300 block of Lucia Street. Then it gained altitude as it headed over the oil fields and agricultural lands beyond that. But if you look at a map of where the units were at the time, it appears that when it made the diagonal turn inland just past the Edison plant, this was a move that was designed to accomplish a very important thing. A short distance south of the generating plant was a Redondo Beach pier. And at the end of the pier were two 155-millimeter guns. Now, the 3-inch and 37-millimeter guns installed elsewhere, they would work against terrestrial craft. But something the size of this monster, it would have had very little impact. But a 155-millimeter, in effect, howitzer would, in fact, when it fired a full 6-inch in diameter projectiles, it would definitely have had an impact, even on something as massive as that craft. Now, while the unidentified flying object seemed to have had the ability to withstand the anti-aircraft rounds without incident, but a close-range impact from a 155-millimeter round, especially if both guns fired in tandem, would certainly have had quite an impact. The same is true when the object first turned south along the surf line near El Segundo and headed toward Redondo Beach and considerably lowered its altitude. The reason it skirted just above the surf line at a low elevation was because sitting between El Segundo and Redondo Beach and the city of Manhattan Beach were two of the most formidable weapons it would have encountered along its path. Even more so than the 255mm guns on the Redondo Beach Pier. Because in the center of Manhattan Beach, just a few blocks inland off the ocean, were two huge 8-inch railway guns mounted on specially built flat cars, sitting on a spur track that had been laid just for these guns. They fired a 500-pound projectile, and its range was up to 20 miles. And unlike the Redondo guns, they were able to rotate all the way around in a full 360-degree arc. They just weren't able to fire at an object so close in just above the beach. And even if they did, everything in their path between the end of the gun and the beach would have been pulverized. So by going in that low, the craft was able to just slip by, which shows, number one, they had a reason to go in low. And number two, they apparently knew what weapons they would encounter along their path. And the fact that this craft made the decision to make the diagonal turn over Redondo Beach just prior to reaching the pier and then cutting across the flatlands and going in behind the sea-facing 16-inch coast defense guns at Fort MacArthur wasn't a bad idea either. A single hit by one of their 2,240-pound projectiles that had a range of 26 miles would more than likely have brought down this craft, whatever it might have been. Now, it flew over Los Angeles County in 1942. There's no doubt that something mysterious was in the air at that time. Now, this alert that was sparked initially as a standard air raid turned into something else. Searchlights and guns were locked onto the aircraft for about an hour. Now, if you look at the military action in Iraq, pictures of batteries of anti-aircraft guns firing what look like random patterns are, you know, we've all seen that. But the pictures that appeared in the L.A. Times in a story about the Battle of L.A. shows a nighttime defensive response to an air raid, but the situation is very different from what we've seen today. The men firing the guns weren't searching the sky trying to find a mysterious enemy. They had their target. They were focused in on it. Now, when the photo that was in the picture, well, that was in the paper, it's run through Adobe Photoshop, you can clear the image up into something that clearly shows a classic saucer-shaped UFO, right in the center where all the searchlights are aimed. When you look closely and carefully, there's no doubt that against the night sky, this darker mass can be clearly seen. The area outside the highlight appears to be clouds of smoke from the explosions are being illuminated by the lights. And if you look closely at the explosions and anti-aircraft rounds, they don't look like they're actually coming in contact with the craft. Witnesses told LA Times reporters that they were watching the bombs explode in rings around the craft, as if the craft had shields similar to the shields on the alien craft in... Well, now, what has happened to my, the light beam, the searchlight beams that were centered in on this craft are quite bright before they reach the object. and you don't see any light beams above the object. So it wasn't just clouds of smoke, as the military tried to say. It was something solid that was in the air above the city. And of course, there are a lot of scientists that got involved in the discussions, trying to estimate the size of the craft and go through all the gyrations that they were known for. But the long and the short of it is, there was something huge in the clouds above the city of L.A. that night. Now, the Battle of L.A. makes a very convincing argument for the presence of alien craft in our skies. I mean, had that been, for example, Japanese aircraft, they would have been splattered all over the landscape. So many, 10 tons of rounds going up at them. But the fact that hundreds of thousands of witnesses saw this thing as it traveled without any effect, there was something very definitely beyond our understanding. Now, since Pearl Harbor had happened only 3 months before this incident, it's very easy to believe the Japanese were responsible. But even the Japanese said they didn't have any aircraft in the skies above L.A. on that night or any other. Now, they did shell the oil refinery from a submarine. And yes, some of their submarines did have light reconnaissance aircraft that they could launch. But there was no such event that can be laid at the Japanese door that night. And even after all these years, no country has aircraft that can continue to fly without any apparent damage after being hit with even one anti-aircraft shell. Yeah, this aircraft did not appear to be hostile. The pilots of the craft had wanted to hurt somebody. They certainly had the chance. Now, maybe the craft was armed, maybe it wouldn't, but the point is, what was it doing there in the first place? There wasn't a single mention in any story about the craft doing anything hostile. Didn't drop bombs, didn't fire back at the gun emplacements, didn't drop paratroops. But it could have been a show of force, putting us on notice that there was nothing we could do to them, even if it became a shooting war between them and us. Now, they ignored the provocation of our attempts to destroy him. Maybe the craft was designed with anti-aircraft gunfire in mind. But more than likely, scientists were correct. The craft was built so strong because of another concern. Since they have a way to propel the craft at extremely fast speeds in open space, and of course there are objects in space, if it hit a piece of rock or a piece of metal the size of a dime, it could be destroyed. But not if it had shields of some sort. Now, that doesn't mean they weren't concerned about protecting their craft from attack. I mean, the fact that they avoided the 8-inch guns and the 155mm guns shows that they were somewhat concerned about what might happen in the event they were on the receiving end of one of those shells. Now, the Battle of Los Angeles happened 5 years before the Roswell event. And long before the idea that an unidentified flying object might be an alien craft was very widespread. Now, certainly in 1897, we had the Aurora crash. But even that didn't raise much discussion outside the area where it happened. The government simply said the craft they were shooting at was unidentified. They let everyone assume that it was the Japanese. I mean, frankly, how many people even questioned the idea the craft had to have been Japanese? We were at war with them. And what would have happened if, for some reason, or in some manner, we actually brought that craft down? I mean, the government had enough trouble covering up what happened at Roswell. What would happen if something the size of that craft hit an apartment building in the middle of L.A.? But suppose it crashed out of sight in the ocean. Well, there has been a number of discussions about the fact that during this time period, the Navy recovered a crashed UFO and started reverse engineering it. Perhaps this craft did go down in the ocean. There's been a lot of discussion that the Navy has had the lead in UFO research, at least since World War II. Maybe this is where they got the impetus. Now, some witnesses claim that the craft appeared to be coming in for a landing. Could it have been having mechanical problems unrelated to our attack, or was trying to land, not realizing L.A. was inhabited by, shall we say, less than friendly inhabitants? And then there are those that claim the craft involved in the crashes in Roswell were... excuse me. Affected by the radar systems being implemented at the time. Well, we now have information that there was radar in use in L.A. What type was that? What would happen if one of these craft appeared over Dallas or Boston today? What would happen? Would we try to shoot it down? There has been a lot of discussion of UFO was brought down over Long Island. Government went in, cleaned up the site, and kept it very quiet. There was a fairly recent incident at Chicago O'Hare that shut down some of the runways as a UFO was acting like it wanted to land. It was hovering over the airport in plain view of everybody and their brother. Of course, the government and the military didn't see it. Some of the employees at the airport were disciplined for admitting to the news media a UFO was actually snarling up the flight schedule. And then there was an incident. Somebody sent me an email about it. President Clinton was holding a news conference, and it was later noted that there was a UFO in the background in some of the shots. Now, in the 60s, at a place called Bickles Camp, located in the desert about 100 miles north of L.A. A UFO was seen by three men. It was huge. It was described as an enormous dark object, shaped more or less like an inflated life raft, according to one of the three men that saw it. The sky was clear. It was a brilliant, star-studded night. And everything was still. But once that thing appeared in the sky, it was like being deaf. Everything was still and silent. You couldn't hear animals, insects, or even the wind. Well, now, the story of over 1,440 anti-aircraft rounds being fired at an unidentified flying object over L.A. has never been seriously challenged. Of course, they wanted us to believe that it was war nerves and 10 tons of ammunition was wasted. However, since that time, there have been 5 classified documents leaked that trace the beginning of a reverse engineering project for non-terrestrial craft back to that 1942 event. According to the documents, 2 U.S. presidents were aware of the top-secret project. One memo provides evidence the U.S. military recovered 2 craft believed to be of interplanetary origin, prompting the investigation of War Department files for evidence of any other such craft. The documents also discuss the existence of a special committee on non-terrestrial science and technology. And there's the implication the government had an interest in supporting the study of non-terrestrial biology. Now, I know there was a textbook at the Naval Academy that actually discussed non-terrestrial biology. It was immediately taken out of circulation and vanished. I got to see one copy of it for a short time. The individual who showed it to me wouldn't allow me to make a copy. But it was a standard textbook that discussed several different types of, what I guess we call EBEs. Now, we also have another story that was brought to my attention. According to U.S. Navy radar reports, a craft was spotted moving into the Santa Monica Mountains from the Pacific Ocean in the hours before the Battle of Los Angeles. Claimed that just north of where it was first picked up is Mount Shasta, an area that's long been regarded as an area of mystery and certainly a UFO hotspot. There have also been a number of strange reports and stories, with some people even claiming a top-secret alien base is hidden inside the mountain. Now, I had, at one point, in fact, somewhere I still have the report, that some miners who were looking at the possibility of valuable ore being in and around Mount Shasta actually found their way into a series of tunnels that led to a huge observation room in the upper reaches of the mountain. Now, Mount Shasta's some little ways from Santa Monica, 617 miles to be exact, which to a UFO would be no distance at all. Now, there are a number of possible alien bases thought to be close to Los Angeles. There have been large openings photographed leading from the coast under Southern California. And I had some, a Navy SEAL that I was met at a Comic-Con. He had read some of my books. And he told me that the area in Southern California is honeycombed with underground seas and rivers. And if you're careful, you can go all the way to Nevada through these underground rivers. One is said to extend from San Francisco Bay all the way to I believe they told me, Hawthorne, Nevada. And there's a military base that contains a lake that's referred to as an inland submarine base. And supposedly, you can go from that base to the ocean by submarine. If that is the case, then that would explain a lot of the odd activity that's been reported in Southern California. Now, in regard to Mount Shasta, I've had stories told to me. At one point in time, I lived in California, and that's when I first started my show on KORG Radio in Anaheim, California. And people used to call me with stories about strange lights and glowing objects seen and reported in the area around Mount Shasta. And some of the reports stated that there had been such things seen for hundreds of years. Native American tribes in that area believe that inside the mountain is a network of caves that leads to an inner city where a race of reptilian creatures live. Now, I had a book, I think Bill Hamilton arranged for me to get it, and it talked about the fact that there had been a tribe that lived underground in Southern California. I don't remember all the details. I'll have to see if I can find it. Now, there are over 100 New Age sects and religious groups that regard Mount Shasta as a sacred source of mystical power. It's been identified by many of these sects as being a cosmic power plant, a UFO landing spot, even an entry point to another dimension. Now, one of the strangest stories that I've heard regarding Mount Shasta is that of a 3-year-old boy who went missing on the mountain for several hours while camping with his grandparents. This was 5 or 6 years ago. He was ultimately found safe and well, and several weeks after the incident, he started to talk about what happened. He said the other grandma, as he called the creature, took him to a secret cave inside the mountain, and the cave was full of guns and spiders. Now, even stranger than that was a story that came from the boy's grandmother. She had had an unusual encounter there a year before, almost in the same spot where her grandson went missing. While camping with her friend, both women awoke to discover they had strange bite marks on the back of their necks. And they both had an intense memory of being watched by a pair of red eyes throughout the night. Well, Dr. Michael Wolff, who wrote a book called Catchers of Heaven, made the claim to have been a consultant to MJ-12, or Majority 12. He claims the modern UFO era began in 1941 when a UFO came down in the ocean west of San Diego and was retrieved by the Navy. Well, what if he was actually talking about 1942? In a letter Dr. Boyan got from the son of Colonel William Brophy, written in response to a Nexus article, he related his father told him in conversation on more than one occasion that the date of the UFO retrieval was not 1941, but actually in February of 1942. This event marked the recovery of the UFO by the Navy off San Diego, and there's actually confirmation of that in the March 5th, 1942 memo from the Army Chief of Staff to the President of the United States, discussing the recovery of a craft. Now, February 25th, 42 is the exact date that the object was seen by hundreds, if not thousands, of people that have crossed somewhere between Palo Verde on the west and Signal Hill on the east before coming out over Long Beach and heading south along the California coast. Then it vanished. Well, if you extend that line further south, you reach San Diego. And as mentioned earlier, when this craft crossed the witness's house on Redondo Beach, it was so low it was thought by many to be coming in for a landing. Or it may have been damaged and was coming down. Well, nobody knows what happened to the craft. The possibility exists it could have gone down in the Pacific somewhere off San Diego. And if it did go down off San Diego and was recovered by the Navy, it's certainly not a widely known fact, even among those who are familiar with most UFO information. It's clearly possible this craft, some distance off the coast west of Seal Beach or Sunset Beach or maybe even Huntington Beach, turned more west-southwest and headed out to sea toward the uninhabited island of San Clemente. Coming down the coast from the north, particularly San Clemente Island is the last and most southern of the Channel Islands, located less than 50 miles off the California mainland and about halfway between Long Beach and San Diego. Could this giant craft have landed for damage assessment or maybe to make some repairs and took off and then crashed into the water off San Diego that was recovered by the Navy? Certainly that raises an interesting question. Well, the whole Southern California, South Bay area extending to the Channel Islands has always been a hotbed of UFO activity. There's been a lot of activity around Catalina Island, and there was even an underground base under or in the water near Catalina. And if you go to Google Earth, you see some interesting things in the water around these islands. Now, this area of the Pacific is certainly no stranger to government projects as well as UFO maneuvers, as I said. Now, we've back-engineered alien technology. I mean, there's a number of books. In fact, Colonel Philip Corsi, not Corsi, Corso, wrote a book called Day After Tomorrow, which talks about the fact that one of his assignments was handling the disbursement of that technology to terrestrial corporations. Now, the San Clemente Island, just off the coast of Southern California, is owned and operated entirely by the U.S. Navy. This high-security island hosts an entire Mount CQB range complex city built specifically for the Navy SEALs. Now, Mount is military operations on urban terrain. That was my specialty in the military. Island's also home to a rocket test facility. Interestingly, San Clemente hosted the SEALAB 3 project in the late 60s, which was an experimental underwater habitat developed to study and support humans living and working in underwater isolation for extended periods of time. Now, what very few people know is the project was repeatedly and mysteriously sabotaged until it was at least officially ended. But when there's funding, when have you ever known the government to permanently end the project? That research project has taken place 50 years before the encounter, so is it really all that strange to possibly be seeing the end result of multiple decades of submarine research in the form of unexplained technology in the area? Well, you've also got Isla Guadalupe, mostly uninhabited. That's off the coast of Mexico, off the Baja Peninsula to be exact. Been a lot of UFO sightings there. And a few fishing encampments on that island are sustained by the Mexican Navy. And the U.S. government set up a weather station on the island in the late 40s at the same time as the Roswell incident and the explosion reported UFO sightings in the American Southwest. Considering the regularity of UFO sightings in Mexico, it doesn't seem far-fetched to think Isla Guadalupe could be home to an advanced black technology research and development facility. late 80s, reports of an unidentified ocean-going craft started being publicized in a lot of different forums. And most of these reports came from a certain stretch of California coastline from about Santa Barbara south to Long Beach. This particular body of water had a widespread reputation as a UFO hotspot, and a lot of witnesses revealed they believed there was an underwater UFO base there. To many of the local UFO researchers, the sightings were no surprise. Ann Druffel, who I got to know in California, said this body of water lies between the coastlines of Southern California and Santa Catalina Island. 20 miles offshore to the southwest, for at least 30 years, this area has been the scene of UFO reports of all kinds. Surface sightings of hazy craft that cruise leisurely in full view of military installations. Spears bobbing in oscillating flight, gigantic cloud cigars. At least one report of an underwater UFO with uniformed occupants. Ours or theirs is a question you have to think about. Another researcher, Robert Stanley, said even in the 60s, families are going down to the beach and waiting for a UFO to pass by. By the 70s, whole families are going down to the beach at Point Duma at night to watch the multicolored UFOs that would sink under the water. And Bill Hamilton, a UFO field MUFON field investigator who I got to know in California, wrote, for years, witnesses have seen many types of UFOs cruising off the Palo Verde Peninsula in Southern California. They've been seen to come out of the water in the San Pedro Channel. One researcher who put together a list of all the recorded ocean-going encounters in that area came up with more than 50 sightings. Excuse me. The first and most common type or cases that take place over the coastline. People see the UFO either from the shoreline or while they're out at sea. The earliest we've got a report on is 1953. Engineer Frederick Hare and several others on Santa Monica Beach when they observed a squadron of saucers performing maneuvers in a daylight sky over the bay. Later that day, the objects returned and performed more maneuvers for a period of about 10 minutes. Next report's from 1955. Several fishermen off the coast of Newport Beach observe a bluish-silver cigar-shaped object flying overhead at a moderate speed. And 2.5 hours later, a Washington family of three are sailing 13 miles off the coast of Newport Beach on their way to Catalina when they observe a perfectly round gray-white craft about 2,500 feet above their boat. When the object maintains its position over their boat, they radio the Coast Guard, who sends out a plane. When the plane arrives, the object darts away. 1957, early morning in Playa del Rey, three cars driving along the Pacific Coast Highway stall when a large egg-shaped object surrounded in a blue haze lands on the beach a few yards away. Witnesses Richard Kehoe, Ronald Burke, and Joe Thomas exit their cars and observe two strange-looking men getting out of the object. After a few minutes, the figures get back on board, which the object then takes off and disappears out of sight. That same day at 3:50 p.m., an officer and 12 airmen from an Air Force detachment in nearby Long Beach observed six saucer-shaped objects zooming across the sky. And then officers at Los Alamitos Naval Air Station report seeing numerous objects crisscrossing the sky. December 57, the crew of the British steamship Ramsey observes a large metallic gray disc with antenna-like projections off the coast of San Pedro. 1960, actor Chad Everett and two friends are on the rooftop of his Beverly Hills home one night when they see a lighted object moving back and forth at high speeds over the ocean. Because the object moves so quickly and at right angles, the witnesses are convinced it's a UFO. 1970, Bill Hamilton investigated one where an anonymous gentleman sailing from Catalina to San Pedro observed a metallic saucer with four hemispherical pods underneath it flying only a few hundred feet above his boat. May of 73, art director George Gray observes an object sending down a beam of light while driving along the Pacific Coast Highway in Santa Monica in the pre-dawn hours. He said the UFO was over where the beach was, hovering, I'd say, about 100, maybe 200 feet in the air. Silver, basic UFO. Definitely completely metallic with a silver dome on top and a silver dome on the bottom, like two plates put together. Had little lights all around the rim. In the summer of 1988, professional photographer Pim Carlsberg observes a darting star-shaped object while relaxing in her Malibu beachfront home. Suddenly, the object moves directly toward her. The brilliant point of light advanced till it became a luminous sphere about 50 feet in diameter, she said. It ominously hung in the air 100 feet from my window. The standoff lasted no more than a minute before the craft departed as quickly as it appeared. Went diagonally through the night sky and vanished. Summer of 1990, private pilot Toshi Inui and his student observe a large red glowing spear, a cigar-shaped object, hovering near their craft as they fly over Santa Monica Bay in the late afternoon. May 4th, 1990, my birthday. Early in the morning, two Malibu surfers are lying on their surfboards waiting for the next wave when they observed a brushed aluminum saucer with a bump in the middle. It approached the shoreline from out of the fog bank, sitting about a mile offshore, and it darted back and forth before moving back out to sea. 1998, Adam and Mario, military private, are driving along the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu when they see six black, diamond-shaped objects darting at high speed up and down the coast. Two men are so impressed by the brief sighting, they spend the next hour driving up and down the coast, hoping to see it again. January 3, 2004, young Chiron is standing along the Santa Monica coast at midday when he sees a metallic, saucer-shaped craft hovering a few thousand feet directly above a small yacht less than a mile out to sea. He took a photograph. Well, it should be clear UFOs are witnessed over this coastal area in disproportionately large numbers. Most cases are observed a few thousand feet or less above the surface of the ocean. So it's plausible to speculate the craft may be traveling into and out of the Pacific. Well, this next group of UFOs has been seen doing exactly that. Now, these are rarer cases, and they provide further evidence of an underwater UFO base off the California coast. November 21st, 1951, Harold Wilkins wrote several books. He reported several witnesses observing an unidentified burning object descending into the ocean somewhere off the coast of California. Now, that could have been burning, or it could have been superheated by quick entry into the atmosphere. August 8, 1954, the Japanese steamship Aliki is off the coast of Long Beach when several members of the crew see an underwater UFO. Intercepted radio message from the ship said saw a fireball move in and out of sea without being doused, left wake of white smoke, course erratic, vanished from sight. 1955, residents of the Northern California coastal town of Santa Maria observed a long silvery object emerging from the ocean and taking off into space. January 15, 1956, residents of Redondo Beach report seeing a large glowing object glide down out of the sky and float on the surface of the ocean about 75 yards offshore. Dozens of witnesses converge on the scene, including a local night watchman, Redondo Beach lifeguards, and police officers from Hermosa Beach. As the crowd gathers, the water around the object start to froth, and the UFO sinks beneath the surface. The glow of the object remains so intense it can still be seen even when it's underwater. Police officers radio for assistance and divers are brought in to investigate, but by the time the divers arrive, the object is gone. Another police officer tests the area with a Geiger counter, but doesn't register any radiation. Another search the next day reveals no results. February 9, 1956, military personnel observe a fireball descending into the ocean off the coast of Redondo Beach. A year later, UFO researcher Leonard Stringfield obtains an official report on the incident that says only a fireball hits the water, submerges. July 28, 1962. Captain of a chartered fishing boat notices lights floating on a stationary position in the water about 6 miles south of Catalina. On closer observation, the captain startled to see what he assumes is a Russian sub. He said it appeared to be the stern of a sub. We could see 5 men, 2 in white garb, 2 in dark trousers and white shirts, and 1 in a sky blue jumpsuit. We passed a beam at about a quarter mile, and I was certain it was a submarine lying low in the water, steel gray, no markings, decks almost awash. Suddenly, the submarine heads straight for the fishing boat as if to ram it. Captain makes an emergency turn as the sub moves past him at high speed, emitting no noise and leaving no wake, just a good-sized swell. Captain contacts the Navy, which is able to possibly identify the sub. But if we reverse engineered enough of these craft, that could well be a naval vessel. I have the classified one. UFO researchers Carl and Jim Lorenzen hear about the case and speculate it may have been a UFO, not a submarine. The high speed, lack of wake and sound, and a huge swell make it the object suspect, they said. Might also mention the odd shape of the submarine itself, its lack of fear of observation and its aggressive maneuvering. By February 4th, 1964, 11 passengers are rescued by the Coast Guard from their emergency raft following the unexplained sinking of their yacht, the Hetty D. Crew was sailing south down the coast of California from Seattle when that craft was either struck or rammed by an unidentified steel object. One of the crewmen said, "I don't care how deep it was, what hold us was steel and a long piece. No give at all." December 2nd, 1965, Ms. Irwin Cohen and her son observed a glowing red object descending into the sea off San Pedro, setting off a large cloud of steam. As the object descends, the witnesses snap a few photos. They wonder if they witnessed a Navy missile or some other unknown object that was not a UFO. October 1968, George Heiner is fishing in his boat off the eastern end of Catalina Island when he spots a white dome-shaped object through his binoculars. As he watches, the object raises 10 feet above the surface of the water and then descends and rises again. Notice the strange parachute-like device beneath the object, which gently descends and then sinks beneath the waves. June of 1980, therapist Linda Susan Young and a friend are driving along the Pacific Coast Highway in Santa Monica at night when Young observes an unusually bright light floating in place several miles out to sea. Young was puzzled by its appearance and turned to her friend. I said to the guy with me, "What do you suppose that is?" And he looks and he only saw it for a second when it just shot up in the air and blinked out. Didn't look like it went far enough to disappear from view like a distance. It just sort of stopped. They assumed it was a UFO. 1980s, a senior electronics engineer sailing on a foggy day between Santa Barbara Island and Santa Cruz Island observed a fluorescent green-colored light ahead of him in the mist. Thinking it's another ship using bright lights to navigate the fog, he stops, waits for it to pass. As it approaches, though, he's unable to distinguish any detail. When it's a quarter mile away and heading directly toward him, he discovered why. He finally realized that this thing was underwater. He said, it was maybe 300 feet in diameter. I couldn't see any vertical dimension to it because it was under me in the water. Literally passed directly underneath my boat. Now, the witness was sailing a fully equipped 38-foot sailboat. When the object passed underneath him, he took several readings from the depth sounder, determined the object was about 100 feet deep. At this point, both depth sounders quit functioning. Witness checked his compass. All three were slowly rotating. He tried to call the Coast Guard, and the radio was dead. Well, the object moved away and disappeared, leaving the witness badly frightened. Later check on his equipment revealed that all the compass mountings were broken. He said, "It was weird. I was just too damn petrified to move." Then in 1990, according to Bill Hamilton, starting in late 89, numerous witnesses in Marina Del Rey began to have repeated encounters with strange blue-green lights in the water. According to Hamilton, in 89 and again in 90, witnesses have seen as many as 20 events an hour. One large light appeared to be as much as 100 feet in diameter, and they spawned babies no larger than 10 to 12 feet in length. Lights were seen to move swiftly under the ocean surface, 500 to 1,000 feet from the coastline in Abalone Cove. One of the lights was reported to have emerged from the water. Spring of 1991, early morning hours, the witness looked out the window of his Malibu beachfront home and observed a brilliantly lit object floating on the ocean surface about 2 miles away. Looked like a big prism, he said, kind of various colors out there. I got a telescope and looked at it. After a few hours, it went out. 2 years later, in January 93, the object came back. He said, I got the telescope out and looked at it, and it was the same kind of thing. For lack of a better word, the colors seemed pure. It really seemed coherent. He called the Coast Guard, but they didn't have any information. May 5th, 1992, two friends walking along Malibu Beach observed a sort of light fireball descend from the sky and drop into the ocean. According to one witness, it was going at an incredible speed and it was less than a mile away. It looked like it hit the ocean. Once the object made its way to the ocean surface, it disappeared. So he guessed it went underwater. 1994, two men walking on the coast of Rancho Palo Verdes at night see several glowing discs floating in the water. One of the witnesses returns at a later date and sees the disc again. On this occasion, he observed several black helicopters in the area. Later, he was confronted by unnamed individuals who tell him in no uncertain terms, this area is off limits. January 11, 2002, an anonymous gentleman camping along the coast at Point Magoo sees a light moving back and forth 100 feet above the water and two other lights beneath the surface of the sea. The objects dart back and forth in tandem for 30 minutes, giving the witnesses the impression they're searching for something. Afterwards, the light in the sky accelerates out of sight and two objects in the water dive down and disappear. There's been so much underwater UFO activity in one place, it's undeniably unusual and strongly points to the possibility there's an underwater UFO base somewhere in this area. And when you think about the fact that this is a very short distance, relatively speaking, from Los Angeles, then it's certainly within the realm of possibility that the craft that caused the so-called Battle of Los Angeles could well have crashed in this area. I mean, all these witnesses weren't all making things up. 1967, two 11-year-old boys experienced an episode of missing time while on their parents' boat in Avalon Harbor at Catalina. Years later, one of the witnesses goes under hypnosis and recalls that he and his friend were abducted to an apparently underground base where they were examined by praying mantis-type ETs. He said, I was taken to a round-walled room. It seemed to me more underground than it did on board a ship. Walls had kind of a rock-like facet to them, rather than craft-type walls. It gave the impression I was in a cavern rather than a ship. Following the examination, I returned to the boat with no conscious memory of the abduction. Early 1990s, as recorded in her autobiographical book, Beyond My Wildest Dreams, Kim Carlsberg, the photographer, experienced a series of UFO abductions from her Malibu home starting in the early 90s. On each occasion, she's examined either by a gray or a praying mantis-type ET. On August 30th, 1992, Carlsberg recalls being taken what appears to be a vast underground complex where she sees many other abductees and ETs of various types. Then a final piece of evidence for an underwater or underground base comes from the Topanga Canyon UFO wave of 92 through 94. Now, the ETs during that instance seemed puzzled by the fact that there was a large group. In fact, Ann Druffel wrote about it. A lot of gay couples lived in that area, and the aliens were puzzled by what they considered the fact that none of these couples were able to reproduce. They couldn't understand it. Now, Topanga Canyon's been a UFO hotspot for more than 50 years. On the night of June 14, 1992, hundreds of unidentified craft were seen in the canyon, which is situated along the Southern California coast. 17 adult witnesses have independently reported seeing UFOs on that evening. One couple who live high on a ridge overlooking the ocean observed about 200 craft rising one by one from behind the ridge east of them and then moving in various locations in the canyon. Well, as can be seen by the list I just went over, the evidence is pretty strong. There's an underwater base in the Santa Catalina Channel. Hundreds of UFOs have been seen in the area. And a significant portion of these cases involve objects going into or coming out of the water. And there are cases where people have apparently been taken inside this very base. Now, it's hard to say exactly where the base is, but judging from the geographic distribution of encounters, the highest density of cases is along the Santa Catalina Channel, which you have to be very deep to avoid detection, unless we know about it and have just been covering it up. Now, the modern age of UFOs is said to have begun in 1947 when a huge wave of sightings swept across the U.S. and the world. That was the year that Kenneth Arnold had his sighting of the 9 silver craft that were skimming along like a rock thrown across the ocean. Then in July of 1947, just after the Roswell crash, two teenagers along the beach at San Rafael watched as a flat, glistening object came out of the ocean, flew a short distance, and dove back into the water 400 yards from shore. So what's going on? Well, that'll be the basis of our next show, seeing if we can put all this together. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.